Welcome to the ESVS podcast. I am Laurence Bertrand, and today we are recording live at the LMU University Hospital in Munich, speaking with Professor Tilim Paris, head of vascular surgery and an internationally recognized expert in aortic dissection management. In this episode, we'll focus on the technical aspects, planning, and decision-making involved in treating aortic dissections, an area where every millimeter and every decision counts. Professor Tilim Paris, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me with you. I look forward to our discussion.
Let's start with the basics. We're going to talk about indications and timing to begin with. In your practice, what are the main indications for intervention in aortic dissection? How do you approach the subacute or inflammatory phase?
Well, I think that, first of all, one has to recognize this is the most challenging part of the aortic work. These are the cases where it come in all possible configurations, what I like to call the chameleon of aortic surgery, because of the different appearances that we have. Having said that, the typical indications, of course, for early intervention and the acute setting is a rupture, which is very rare, and most commonly the malperfusion of end organs and the lower limbs. What is also something that, of course, in the chronic phase, the absolute indication is the aneurysmal degeneration. And when we have an aneurysm more than 55, we start thinking about intervention and operation, and of course, over 60 for sure. But there are also other more relative indications, like, as we know, the high-risk features that we need to consider when we see some dissections, and we're talking, of course, mainly here about type B dissections, some high-risk features that we see in some of these patients, like the early dilatation over 40 millimeters, the very rapid expansion, the very high-intensity pain which is not controlled, or the blood pressure that is not controlled and is also sometimes associated with renal malperfusion, even if it's not a complete malperfusion of the target vessel. These are just a few examples, and I think one should read the guidelines, also the 2026 thoracic guidelines that I had the pleasure and honor to work on, which will give a lot of guidance in all of these topics.
Okay, well, we look forward to that. Let's unpack that a little bit. You already talked about high-risk features. We'll talk about that in a minute. First, timing. Now, do you think that there is a best window for intervention during the subacute phase, balancing inflammation and tissue fragility? Is there a moment where you say, okay, this person really needs to be done? What do you find as a good moment to sort of try?
Well, I think this is the question we're all trying to figure out right now, and we are all trying to have these studies that will help us figure out really what is the best timeline for intervention in acute type B dissection, and whether hyperacute, acute, or subacute, or chronic is the best way to go, or if it is the best way to go at all, intervention, I mean. And this is still an unanswered question. I can tell you what we are currently doing in our institution. We are still very cautious in going into the acute phase, so the early 15 days, and doing aortic intervention. We try to get patients, if they are in a stable condition, which means they don't have a malperfusion, they don't have signs of a contained rupture or periaortic hematoma or anything that would be concerning in our eyes. And they also don't have what I like to call sometimes hidden malperfusion, so an extremely high pressure that is not controlled with multiple IV medication. Some patients have five oral medications and sometimes still need IV medicine. These are the patients that, in my eyes, should be treated earlier, even in the acute phase. If they don't have all these characteristics, we try to get them all out of the acute in the subacute phase, so after the 15 days for the aortic stenting. What we, however, still do in these 15 days, if it's a younger patient, we still have the practice that we always like to land in an absolutely healthy landing zone, which is in 95% of the cases in front of the left subclavian artery, so between the left carotid and the left subclavian. So we need to revascularize the left subclavian artery. So what we do in the younger patients, where we choose to go for a carotid subclavian bypass for the revascularization of the left subclavian, is to first do the carotid subclavian bypass in this window, even if it's the acute phase, then make a pause and get the bag in the subacute phase to complete the stenting.
Right, so then in that case, if things took a turn for the worse, you would actually already have the bypass in place to react more quickly if needed.
Yes, Right. Pretty much.
I see. You've answered this a little bit already. We're going to talk about this concept of high-risk features. So in so-called uncomplicated type B aortic dissections, there's still a concept of high-risk features that's something in between complicated and uncomplicated, and it's kind of debated by some people. Now, in your view, which of these features truly matter when deciding whether to intervene early versus continue medical therapy?
Also a very, very hot debate indeed. Over the years, we have had the situation that every paper would come up with a risk factor based on 5 patients, 10 patients, 15 patients that had an event.
Small caseloads.
Very small caseloads that had these characteristics, and still these came up as predictive factors for aneurysm growth and late interventions in some studies. So I would say that, you know, in the order of importance, mm-hmm. the very early aneurysmal dilatation over 40 millimeters mm-hmm. is probably the most convincing factor that we should consider in terms of how the remodeling, the early remodeling is mm-hmm. is going to happen. That's what we know for the very few randomized control studies that we have. Mm-hmm. And other factors like, you know, the large entry point or the yeah. entry at the small curvature or the size of the false lumen compared to the true lumen. These are things that are really based on very weak evidence. Mm-hmm. And these are things that we take into consideration, but they do not reflect our absolute criteria to go more forward with early intervention. A very difficult topic for me is the topic of persisting hypertension. Mm-hmm. Because we do try to get those patients on the conservative side and try to manage them with high dose or multiple drugs for antihypertensive care. But having a patient out there with 160 blood pressure and with a aortic dissection that is still very fresh is not something that can easily do. This is something that we are still very cautious with, and we are more aggressive than what the evidence tells us. So these patients, we do go sometimes for early intervention, even if we know there is not huge evidence behind that. But that is also because we're probably never going to get so much evidence. Is such a difficult topic.
Even in the subacute phase, you might consider that.
These patients are the patients that we might consider doing them even in the acute phase.
Okay, thank you for that. Let's move on to planning and sizing. When planning endovascular treatment, what principles guide your sizing of stent grafts? Oversizing, use of barbs, particularly in terms of avoiding retrograde dissections. Are we never using barbs, or are there moments where you think, actually, this is a very old dissection, we're going to need some grip there, that's it might be a reason to use it? Or is this a no-go never? And how do you feel about oversizing in dissections?
I think key point is always healthy landing zone. Mm-hmm. One has to take a very good look at the landing zone up front and make sure that there is no intramural hematoma or the rest of dissection in the area where you land. That's something that we have seen a lot of times with people who try to land right at the level of the left subclavian artery where the dissection begins, and then the graft kind of opens up, goes to the outer curvature, perforates the membrane, and then you have a major bird picking. So I think the best way to avoid major complications is to bring your stent graft in a straight parallel segment of the aorta as good as it gets. Of course, the length of the proximal landing zone cannot be the 2.5 centimeters
which you would want, yeah.
We would want also based on textbooks and also IFUs. Mm-hmm. But still having a healthy part of the aorta there is very important. That is, in my experience, as I said before, in the left carotid and the left subclavian artery. But you really need to make sure that there is no rest dissection or intramural hematoma there as well. So in the sense of the non-A, non-B dissection. Regarding oversizing, it also depends for oversizing which phase you are. If you're in the acute, subacute, or chronic phase, usually I don't go below 10% because then it's no oversizing and you definitely risk your seal zone. Try to stay not go much over 20% either. So our oversizing is healthy landing zone between 10 to 20%. Barbs, I think barbs add to the stability or in the wall. I don't think that barbs themselves create retrograde dissections. But what has happened and we know can happen is that when you have partially released the graft during deployment and you make movements back and forth, that's a dangerous time where you can create a new entry at the area of the barbs if you move the graft during the time. So should it be necessary to use a graft with barbs, you should definitely make sure not to move the graft a lot during deployment of the first stents.
I have two follow-up questions. One, why would it be necessary to use barbs?
Well, not everybody has every stent on their on themselves, and sometimes there are configurations where also myself prefer to use certain stent grafts that have barbs instead of other stent grafts. So if I have a Gothic arch with a very high angulations, I believe there is, for example, stent grafts like the alpha thoracic that take that curve in the inner curvature better. And I would prefer in that situation that instead of a stent graft that doesn't have barbs. We are doing now a multi-center study registry on a specific stent graft, which is not made for dissection. And we still see that 30% of those patients are treated for with this graft for dissections.
Right, right.
So I think in the real life, people will use in the acute setting
what they have. Yeah, fair enough. The second follow-up question I had is, you said, if I understood correctly, you're oversizing 10 to 20%, and it depends on the acute phase. Am I understanding that correctly, that if you are closer to the subacute phase, you might oversize less, and if it is a more chronic dissection, you're going to be closer to the 20%?
Yes.
Is that right?
Even in the chronic phase, where we know we have a, pretty much we're dealing with an aneurysm more than a dissection, we can also go to 20, 25, 30% sometimes.
Okay.
Depending on the configuration. But 10 to 20 is the golden rule.
Okay, thank you for clarifying. How do you approach oversizing in the case of having a dilated SN aorta? So you have a type B dissection, but the ascending aorta is also dilated, and you're a little bit worried about a retrograde type A dissection occurring.
Yeah, and I think that's an amazing question and an excellent point, because we have actually now running an analysis on some data. We know that dilated ascending aorta is a risk factor for retrograde type A dissections. We have known that for some years. We have had the experience also that sometimes we are very aggressive with our arch branch devices landing in the ascending aorta in more than 38 millimeters diameters, and we saw that that could be a very bad experience for some patients. So I think when one sees that, we should be very cautious and put the indication even more conservatively than we would in other cases. I'm not a big fan of the idea that these patients should get a frozen elephant trunk right away, because we are talking about a fully protective procedure for early dilatation that then goes so far to get a complete arch repair for a 40 millimeter ascending aorta. So we are
it's a lot for something prophylactic.
We make a lot of rational conclusions from A to B to C to to reach a huge operation at Z. So I'm not a great fan of that, but for sure these are the patients we need to address a little more cautiously. And especially if you have a young patient where you also have possible suspicion of a genetic aortic disease, then these patients are the ones who need more attention than anybody.
Fair enough. When you're sizing and you have a true lumen that is perhaps very small, are you going to be sizing very differently? Do you favor oversizing the true lumen only, or are there situations where different strategies is needed? I think there's sometimes debate on how exactly we should be measuring, especially when you have true lumen collapse at certain areas and you're not exactly sure what should I be using to measure.
Yes, that's also a very, very good point and excellent question. No definite answer for sure in terms of data. I can again tell you how we are doing this. In most of the cases you have a true lumen restriction, or not collapse always, but at least it's much smaller than the false lumen, obviously. And the goal is to get from a healthy landing zone down to a dissected portion of the aorta without creating a distal stent graft induced new entry.
Right.
So this can be very challenging sometimes because all the graphs that we have a certain amount of tapering. The maximal is usually about 8 millimeters from the top to the bottom. Mm-hmm. So just putting one piece, which is actually what we say we want in most cases, just cover the entry tear and wait, will lead automatically in a lot of cases to major oversizing in the mid-thoracic aorta. If you go further down, then you extend more distally, then you can do a second tapering, which will take you down to a more distant oversizing, but that's the situation we have to deal with. So what we usually use is the so-called croissant measurement of the dissection, which is taking more or less the length of the dissection membrane and using that as our target size of the stent graft at the distal part, which is the length of the dissection membrane, which of course is much more than the second diameter that you have in the aorta.
If am I understanding this correctly, that instead of having a wall-to-wall measurement, you're using the crescent shape of the dissection membrane and the length of this crescent shape to be the diameter you'd go for?
Pretty much, yes.
Right, okay.
Pretty much. Which means still there is oversizing to one of the dimensions, but you anticipate that the stent graft will open up to that size. And we definitely don't go for the total diameter of the aorta, so true and false lumen, mm-hmm. Unless you are trying to do something, a special technique like stabilize, where you want to bring dissection membrane to the outer wall.
Thank you. Let's move on to talking about target vessels and branch management. How do you decide which branch vessels to stent and how far into the dissected target vessel to extend the stent? Because sometimes the dissections go quite far and you wonder, like, do I really need to cover the dissection all the way to the end? Or can I stop halfway and look at the flow? And does your strategy differ in the arch versus the descending aorta?
First of all, to differentiate again between acute and chronic dissections and how you stent, when we have a situation where we have a dissection in one of the branch vessels, the aorta, so renal, SMA, celiac, we don't deal with that first. We try in all of these cases to first address centrally the problem, which means cover the entry and redirect the flow. Mm-hmm. Into the true lumen. Once you've done that, you will see that a lot of those dissected vessels all of a sudden have normal flow again. Mm-hmm. Or in some cases, they completely lose the flow if they were coming off the false lumen and mm-hmm. probably and you have then a change in the pattern of the dissection membrane. So after we have addressed the issue centrally and we know we don't have a lot of entry tears along the way, we look at the target vessels or the branch vessels. And then if we see there that there is still compromise of the origin in the target vessel, we will try to decide whether we do a stenting, a selective stenting of the target vessel or not, mm-hmm. Which we usually do if the dissection membrane goes into the target vessel and we only cover the origin, also in a way that it doesn't protrude too much in the aorta, so that we can also keep all our late options for a fenestrated branch therapy open. What we have learned not to do is try to bridge vessels that are going off the false lumen and have a greater distance to the true lumen, bridge them all the way to the true lumen, because the dissection membrane is so mobile that these stent grafts or stents that you're trying to place in the target vessel in the false lumen and bridging them all the way to the true lumen, they won't work and they might fall just in the false lumen that have the counterproductive result. So short stents, open up the origin and don't follow it down the road unless you really have a secondary problem in the course of the target vessel.
Okay, so you don't need to stent in the target vessel all the way till the dissection is over, as long as your flow is good from the orifice.
Exactly.
And you mentioned, okay, we're not doing this very long bridging stents anymore where the orifice of a target vessel might be coming off a false lumen. Then we'd rather leave it as is. But doesn't that mean that we might be sacrificing one of these branches then?
Well, there are other techniques that one can use if you have a feeling that there is a malperfusion. First of all, usually the vessels that come off the false lumen completely doesn't mean they're malperfused. You see in the arterial phase of the CT scan that they do not have a contrast filling so early as they do in the with the other vessels that come off the true lumen, but that does not mean that they have a relevant malperfusion that compromises them. Mm-hmm. It just means they're getting the blood a little bit later.
Right.
So this is something that, so that's a radiologic effect, but doesn't mean that it's really an effect in terms of malperfusion. If you think you have that and it's really an effect that is causing malperfusion, you can use other techniques like the fenestration of the dissection membrane, which in the acute phase is more trying to open up. There's always a re-entry on those areas because as the membrane takes off the wall, there is always a hole where the origin of the vessel used to be, and you can catheterize that, go with the wire from the true lumen into the false lumen, and then take a bigger balloon, a 12 millimeter balloon in this area, and open the hole.
Open the tear.
Open the tear so you have more flow into the false lumen exactly at that area and have better perfusion of the target vessel. But that's not something that you very often do. Most people that have tried it, I think I did in one case, people have that do septotomies have gone away from doing septotomies, to fight assisted septotomies in the acute phase because that could be running into big problems.
Thank you for that. Let's talk a little bit about septotomy. Do you do septotomies? What do you think about them? What's your take?
So we've done septotomies. It's not a technique that we have embraced completely in terms of using it very, very frequently. We are very selective users of this technique. I think we have used it in cases where we had a very challenging true-false dissection membrane in a chronic dissection where we wanted to open up the visceral segment to make our catheterization easier. I think that dissection membranes should not be looked at as our enemy always. In quite a few cases and situations, having a dissection membrane that stabilizes the stent graft in one side of a big aorta is not bad at all because it can help you move to fenestrations instead of branches, which we know is better for a lot of patients. For that, it's not something I regularly do. Having said that, there are some situations where you can definitely avoid a bigger operation by doing a septotomy. If you have a good landing zone above the celiac trunk and you can do a septotomy there and bring a standard TVAR down to the celiac trunk, then you could avoid a false lumen occluder, for example. But that's something that is, in my experience or in the cases that I get to see, not that common. However, we have used that technique, for example, in a rupture where we saw that we needed a way to completely seal, and that was a good way to get the seal at the level of the distal thoracic aorta. We don't routinely use it. We use it in selected scenarios where we want to get more room in the paravisceral aorta for branches or fenestrations, but not routinely.
I'd like to ask a little bit more about how to handle the false lumen and flow. So there's ongoing debate about how aggressively we should aim to stop flow in the false lumen. In your opinion, how important is it to complete false lumen flow cessation, and how do you choose between the options, embolization, candy plug, extensive FIVAR, BVAR repair to achieve distal landing zone in non-dissected levels?
Again, an issue where we work a lot without evidence. We know that makes little sense to put a stent graft in the true lumen and redirect flow. Even if you have a bigger tear, if you have huge tears right below your stent graft, because you're still gonna have a very, very relevant flow back in the false lumen. So if you're doing that to protect against aneurysm degeneration, it only has limited effect if you don't go down to the celiac to start with. Then we wait in most of the cases. So when we decide to address the false lumen, I would say we're not very aggressive into a false lumen occluder in the very early phase when we do a protective procedure to enhance remodeling. We are quite aggressive when we already have an aneurysm, because in this case, of course, it doesn't just help to put a true lumen stent graft, but you also need to address the false lumen in order to exclude backflow and therefore exclude the aneurysm, because you are dealing with an aneurysm. So for that, however, you do need to have some kind of a small portion segment of the aorta above the celiac trunk where you can put your false lumen occluder. We don't do embolizations in most of the cases because it is something that we know that's not enough. It's not enough to just throw bands of endotrach in the false lumen. And the last and most reliable way to go is to, of course, do a fenestrate or branch repair, which is, however, the next step of invasiveness in these kind of procedures.
Thanks for talking about that. And how about the choice of target vessel bridging stent? How do you decide between balloon expandable and self-expanding stents, and what factors most influence your choice?
So balloon expandable stents are for us the standard, usually also covered, in order to be able to go again through those stent grafts without fearing that you are going through the struts. You want something that will have radial force and will push the membrane to the wall. And self-expanding stents are, in our practice, usually reserved for more distal pathologies where you want to reinforce the true lumen in a dissected vessel where just opening up the proximal tear was not enough and you have the feeling there are more tears down the vessel and you still have relevant malperfusion along the branch.
Okay, wire handling and access. Let's move on to that. One of the trickiest aspects is working in the false lumen and doing so safely. So how does the wire behave differently there, and what tips do you have for safely navigating it?
Well, that is definitely a fact. Navigating between true and false lumen is one of the most critical aspects of managing dissections. Understanding images is a critical aspect in managing dissections, and getting prepared for treating a dissection is probably the most important thing. Mm-hmm. Which means that when you go into a dissection case, you need to be very well prepared in terms of having a good idea of which vessels go off the false lumen, which vessels go off the true lumen, which points you have an entry and a re-entry, so you know that how your wires and catheter is going to behave. Usually what we do is we try to get access from a vessel that is for sure in the true lumen and is not dissected, so a femoral artery that is not dissected. If the femoral artery, for example, is dissected, we try to understand where is it dissected and how we can get access to the true or false lumen. Most commonly, the femoral artery is not dissected. The dissection stops at the level of the internal iliac artery. And at that level, you, in more than 90% of the cases, I would say that the internal iliac artery goes off the true lumen, which is very interesting. And this is the first indicator of whether you will make it to the true lumen or not. So shooting an angiography in the respective projection right at that level and trying to catheterize the internal iliac artery will help you get into the true lumen. And then you navigate up, not using your wire, but using a pigtail catheter that will prevent you, after you know you're in the true lumen on the lower part, that will prevent you to cross again from a smaller re-entry from the true to the false lumen. So instead of moving up your catheter, your wire, you just move up with your catheter. So, and then you shoot the repeated angiographies along the way to make sure that you don't lose your way across the aorta. And you should again have your preparation worksheet where you know which vessels go off which lumen. Having said that, this is your good way of doing things. IVOS has changed our practice in the last years. So intravascular ultrasound is a very, very useful tool in difficult situations especially, but also routinely. It helps you figure out whether you are in the true or the false lumen. These are a few of the tips, but I think important is also to have all the extremities prepared, prepped and ready to go for, because sometimes you cannot get the access from below, you have to get the access from above and then try to navigate it from the other direction.
Thank you for that. And I'm glad you talked about IVOS. What is the role of IVOS in your procedures? Are you using this to make a decisive difference?
We are using IVOS very often in our dissections. I think there are different ways of how to use it, and there are a lot of arguments. For me, the most important help is to make sure you're in the true lumen first, if mm-hmm. you have any doubts that this might be the true or the false lumen. It is more important when you have bigger reentries down the road where you can really easily pass from true to false lumen, and you don't know on that segment whether you are in the true or the false lumen. What I don't use the IVUS for is oversizing the proximal part, because there you don't have perpendicular positioning of probe of the IVUS to really claim that you can do measurements. You can do that in the straight part of the descending aorta sometimes, especially in the dissections. What I really like using the IVUS for after I have done my TVAR is also to make sure that I don't have true lumen collapse afterwards, which is sometimes the case because it's so dynamic, the dissection membrane, that you still have massive collapses in the diastole and the systole. This is something that could be very difficult to see angiographically. And one last use that I have for the IVUS is to make sure I don't have a retrograde type A dissection.
So you suggest using IVUS in the beginning to make sure that your path is not true, false, true, and also at the end to control what you've done after placing the TVAR.
Yes.
So before we talked about using wires in the false lumen, and if I can summarize, if I've understood correctly, you're saying please know your scans, know what's true and false, where your origins are coming off. You go up with a catheter and do an early and frequent angiograms. Now, you know, sometimes we know that we're in the false lumen and we're trying to get to the true lumen, or we're actually going to put a candy plug in and we're in the true lumen and trying to get into the false lumen. And you do an angiogram before and you can anticipate where the opening might be, you know, your scan, but you don't really know. And when you're moving your wire, you're trying to catheterize into the false lumen. What tricks can you use in how the wire moves to see, oh, I think we've moved from the true to the false lumen, or is it all just gut feeling?
Well, I mean, usually what you see is a different course than the ones you had before.
Okay, so the path is different.
You know just how, what the path is when you're in the true lumen, and after you have done some efforts to take in, to find that entry from the true to the false, you suddenly see that the wire is not at the same path it was before, but mm-hmm. it takes a new path.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I usually understand as it takes a different course, or it behaves differently.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's usually big enough always to have an easy course. Mm-hmm. And it's not like in the peripheral vessels where you can tell whether you're in the true lumen or subintimal.
Right.
And the aorta is, the wire doesn't really behave differently, but you can see that now it goes another way.
And what about stiff wires in the false lumen? Is it always a no-go, or in chronic dissections it's okay? In an acute or inflammatory phase, this is a no-go. Do you think it's okay to use stiff wires in the false lumen if you need to?
Well, you have to if you need to stent.
Mm-hmm.
So that's...
No, in the false lumen.
Well, we also use that as well when we do a candy plug, for example. So that's not something we are afraid of. And also when we do the maneuver of opening up a tear with a balloon, we also use stiffer wire, which goes from the false to the true lumen, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't say that usage of stiffer wires in the false lumen per se is a risk. And definitely making sure that these wires are always under control and you don't press them against the outer wall or the wall is something we will always try to be cautious about. But that's a general rule I would always keep for any wire in the aortic system.
Let's talk about the future and planning for the future. Post-dissection aneurysms are often associated with higher reintervention rates compared with degenerative aneurysms. In your experience, what are the main drivers of these reinterventions, and what strategies can help to improve durability and long-term outcomes?
Well, that of course addresses more the chronic dissections. I would say dissection of the target vessels, and the fact that the distal landing zone is not very secure as it is in other degenerative aneurysms is another important factor. And of course, the fact that these patients have usually big lumbar arteries that are patent is increasing the chance of endoleaks that also contribute to the secondary intervention in these patients.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever leave skips between your stents or gaps, or intentionally in stent coverage? And what are the principles behind that decision? Is that a total no-go, or there's cases where you've done that?
So you mean we do a TVAR and then EVAR just to try? We don't like doing that very much, to be honest, in the sense that you run a big risk of putting an EVAR In the dissected aorta, you pretty much use the dissection membrane, and that can lead to collapse in worst case if you have a persistent pressure on the false lumen, and you have that graft in the true lumen.
You mean collapse of the graft
of the
distally?
Graft and these are something that doesn't make sense in my opinion to do unless you have a secure landing zone from the top to the bottom.
But say we had covered an entry gap at the top with a TVAR, and so many years later the patient develops infrarenally an aneurysm of the dissection. Then to place an EVAR and leave the thoracoabdominal area is not ever thought of?
Well, I think that's the big challenge in these cases is you put something where you still leave the site street open, in this case not the back door but the side street, and that will still perfuse the aneurysm below. So I don't see very much the point in doing that, but I know some people have been doing it with the idea that they treat with that the true lumen collapse of the infrarenal aorta. We don't usually that and try to go for total solutions from top to bottom.
You prefer to go to do the thoracoabdominal part before doing the EVAR, then coming back and having to do the thoracoabdominal area when you've already have an EVAR in place. Okay, let's talk about some closing reflections. If you were to give a top three tips for vascular surgeons tackling complex aortic dissections, what would they be?
I think the single most important thing is be well prepared and have studied the anatomy up front. Know your CT scan, know your patient, of course, and how you will navigate through this aorta, the entrance and the re-entrance down the road. And the second important thing is deal with the problem you are facing and don't try to make things beautiful, but deal with what you're dealing with. Get in, get it done, and get out. You don't have to heal the patient of his aortic dissections, and you will not do it. If you try to do too much, sometimes you get into more trouble that you should. And third is keep your patients close, keep them in surveillance, and make sure that you take the right decision at the right moment. Giving some time in between is not usually something that is always bad.
We don't have to do everything the first go around. It's okay to wait and come back.
Yes.
I see. Now, looking ahead, are there any innovations in devices, wires, or imaging that you think will significantly change aortic dissection management in the next 5 to 10 years? What's coming?
I would have to play the lottery if I knew that. But my guess would be that there is a big discussion about compliance stents that are changing the hemodynamics of the vascular tree less than the ones we're using now. And that's something that might make a big deal. Having solutions that will help us treat a dissection without placing a stent graft are being discussed. There are some first studies in trying to see whether that works or not, and just closing the entries without really treating everything. I think this is a very challenging topic. If should it work, it would be interesting.
Closing the entry tear.
Yeah. I think that's something that has been that some people look into. And of course, these techniques of doing the septotomy in a secure way could be seen differently in a few years if we have more specific devices for that. In general, I think the treatment of dissections, however, will largely remain closely associated with stent graft developments, where we also see a constant improvement of our devices incorporating supra-aortic vessels. And from there, I think that's what will still be what we will mostly do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Professor Stylian Paris, thank you so much for sharing your insights, technical pearls, and personal experiences. Aortic dissection is a challenging field, but episodes like this give our listeners practical guidance that they can carry into their own practice. Thanks to you all for listening to the ESVS podcasts. Don't forget to share this episode with your colleagues and subscribe for more discussions on the cutting edge of vascular surgery. Goodbye for now. Bye-bye.